Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So we're going to start off tonight's program with a science lesson. We'll walk around and kick the tires of a major human operating system, the autonomic nervous system. It all started with a recent article that I came across, an acupuncture research article that caught my eye. First of all, I have to preface this by sharing with you something I heard at an acupuncture conference many years ago from an old, venerable Chinese acupuncture doctor who said something along the lines of, "For longevity, moxa stomach 36 every morning." Or needle. Maybe he said needle or moxa, but I think he just said moxa. Now, moxa means applying a heat to an area, specifically a particular frequency of heat that's generated by burning a sort of incense made of crushed mugwort leaves, Chinese mugwort. Stomach 36 is a location. I'm going to tell you how to find it, because after we finish, you're going to want to know. Of course, you can look it up on the internet, but this is one of the easy ones that I'll often tell people to use for migraine if I'm trying to treat headache. It's also pretty good for reflux, so it's a useful point for a lot of reasons. But if you reach down and find your kneecap and then just go straight south from the bottom of the kneecap, you'll find on the front of your tibia, that's your leg bone, a bump. That bump is where the patellar tendon is attaching. So from the center of that bump, imagine that you're going to go down and out at about a 45-degree angle. And you'll go about an inch or an inch and a half, and you'll find a soft spot right off the edge of that bone. And it might be a little tender if you push on it. That's stomach 36. Stimulating stomach 36. Well, it might be the secret of the universe. Friends, as it turns out, stomach 36 is a general anti-inflammatory program input, and virtually all aging and all disease is basically inflammatory. So if we can turn that puppy down, we can have a profound effect on the workings of the autonomic nervous system. As it turns out, it's all about the vagus nerve, one of the two pillars of the autonomic nervous system. So what does the autonomic nervous system do anyway? Well, a lot. It controls your heart rate, your respiratory rate, your digestion and all of its complexity. It controls orgasm and arousal, tears, saliva, sleep. Yeah, basically just about everything that you have to think about to override, and many things you can't consciously override. All for your own good, of course. If you could override it, you'd probably mess yourself up badly. The autonomic nervous system functions like many things in biology as a push-pull system. It's classic yin-yang, up-down, push-pull, tug-of-war, and that stabilizes the complex system. If both things are pulling opposite directions, then you can have very, very fine tuning. When I think about that, the image of driving a car actually came to mind. When you're driving very, very fast and a tiny little deviation from the center line is going to take you off the road, you keep both hands on the wheel. And that is effectively what you're doing with the autonomic nervous system. It's comprised of two pieces. The sympathetic portion, of which we call the sympathetic system, that runs on epinephrine and norepinephrine and is intimately related with the output of the adrenal gland, and the parasympathetic system, which runs on acetylcholine and is responsible for most of digestion and much of slowing down the heart, the control of respiration. So you can think of the parasympathetic nervous system as rest and digest, and the sympathetic nervous system as fight or flight. So if we go to the immune system, the analogy would be fight or flight. Well, that's because there's a threat, so we're going to fight that threat. In the case of the parasympathetic, it's, yeah, you know, that's a little more inflammation than we need. Maybe that's not such a big threat. Maybe we should chill and not overreact. When you look at a map, anatomic map of the autonomic nervous system, what you see is that all of this is starting in the brain, of course, but it's running down the outside of the spinal column. So this is super, super interesting. The movement and the sensation that comes into our brain and goes out from our brain to move our body around, that's for the most part in the center of the spinal column. But the ganglia, that is to say the place where the cells synapse from the brain to the periphery in the autonomic nervous system, is outside of the spinal column, and it's just in a separate chain. It's like we really have effectively two spinal columns. The vertebral ganglia on either side contains all of the sympathetic and the parasympathetic fibers. Oddly enough, they divide up in a very interesting way. So the stuff in your neck and the stuff in your lower sacrum, your tail effectively, that's all parasympathetic. I'm thinking about my dog wagging her tail. That's definitely a parasympathetic signal to me. I can't see my dog wag her tail without feeling a little happy and a little relaxed. And the neck, well, think about how relaxing and a neck rub is. And think about when you're tense, how much the muscles of your neck, the first place that it goes in most of us. And so you could see how a neck rub would stimulate those parasympathetic ganglia just by touch and probably cause them to fire. So what do we get? Well, we get constriction of the pupil, tear production and saliva, and also the production of all of the digestive juices from the stomach, the stimulation of bile, the stimulation of all the secretions, and of course, the parasympathetic system promotes voiding, and the parasympathetic system is really intrinsically related to a push-pull with the sympathetic system when you talk about sexual activity. That enormous sense of fulfillment and relaxation and peace and calm and all that stuff that you get after the act itself, pure parasympathetic system. You can also increase your parasympathetic activity by slow, deep breathing. This is one of the most basic and simple ways to have control over that. Remember that thing that they always taught you when you were a little kid, hold your breath and count to 10 before you act out or get angry? Well, yeah, guess what? The sympathetic system, on the other hand, fight or flight, it dilates pupils, the better to see you with, my dear. It relaxes the airways so that you can breathe harder and faster to run or fight. It accelerates the heartbeat so you can deliver more energy to the muscles. It stimulates sweat production to, guess what, cool those muscles. It stimulates glucose production and release. And this is super important because if you're excited and uptight all the time, that's going to increase your risk of developing diabetes. Crazy, huh? Well, it also inhibits digestion, so it contributes to, among other things, constipation. If you have a high sympathetic activity, you're going to have trouble letting go. It inhibits voiding because this is not the time to pee if you're running away from a predator. And of course, that excitement and rapid heartbeat that we feel during sexual arousal, pure sympathetic nervous system. These are not good or bad, but it's classically how they're controlled. It's a beautiful illustration of the enormous complexity of the nervous system. Now we're going to jump sideways and think about the anatomy of the acupuncture channels. You've probably all seen one of those mannequins that sit out there that have all of the lines going up and down. And if you go down and look just down and out from the kneecap, you will see one labeled stomach 36. What is going on with these channels? Well, if you look at them anatomically, they're the negative space, effectively, in our body. They're the place between the muscles, between the organs and the blood vessels. This is the place where we have fascia. We have this strange fluid that's interstitial fluid. It's a salty fluid. It can carry an electrical charge. And there's plenty of evidence showing that things move more rapidly along these channels, not as rapidly as they move through the nerves. The nerves are designed for speed, but certainly faster than just diffusing through tissue. So something's going on in the space between. We don't have a geometer. We can't measure the flux of whatever this energy is, but we can state, without fear of contradiction, that whatever it is, you can stimulate it with electricity. You can stimulate it with magnetism. You can stimulate it with mechanical pressure. You can stimulate it with heat. And you can stimulate it with light or lasers. And what are we stimulating? We're stimulating certain points on these channels called acupoints. And if you look at the anatomy, most of the acupoints, we're talking way over 80% of them, have a particular conformation where a nerve trunk, and it's a fairly large nerve root, relatively large, not fairly large, I guess, but a large small fiber, let's put it that way, a collection of large small fibers in a bundle and blood vessels. There seems to be, when you put a needle into these points, we have electron microscope data that show us that by twisting the needle, you actually tug on the membranes, on the fascia, and you produce a flow of electric signaling, or at least I shouldn't say electrical, I should say you produce a flow of electrons that are mainly being carried by sodium channels, and you get information. And it's a code. The speed with which you twist the needles, the direction you twist the needles, they get very, very esoteric in Chinese medicine. But really, just taking a blunt stick, like the kind that you use to clean under your fingernails, and pressing on that will stimulate stuff in your brain. And you can see the brain light up when you do it. So there's a clear one-to-one correspondence. And we have finally the technology to say, hey, these acupuncture points are really doing something. So let's get back to the vagus nerve and stomach 36. A couple of weeks ago, I gave you a story about microbiome and the vagus nerve and how it's really clear that what's going on in our microbiome is sending tons of signals from the gut into the brain and, for the most part, either reducing or increasing the activity of the vagus nerve. And this may be the core way that the microbiome influences inflammation, because this study looking at stomach 36 certainly suggests that. Let's start with the idea that there are these autonomic reflexes. Just like the knee-jerk reflex that's a spinal reflex, there are autonomic reflexes such that when you stimulate an acupuncture point, you can modulate body physiology at distant sites. We've demonstrated that a lot. But the ideas that we've been struggling with in acupuncture research include how point specific is it, and what is it about these different points that cause that specificity? This particular article published just this October 13th, so very, very recently, it's really, really a game changer. What the researchers did was they looked in mice at stomach 36, and they compared electrical stimulation at this point with electrical stimulation at stomach 25. And what they were able to find is a specific type of sensory neuron, which you only find in the deep fascia of the limbs. You don't find it in the abdominal fascia. That has to do with the fact that they come from different places embryologically. And embryology turns out to be really critical for acupuncture. It's as if qi may be one of the driving factors that allows, qi signaling may be one of the things that allows for the development of this complex three-dimensional physical entity that is the human or the mammalian body. If you stimulate stomach 36 in mice, what you find is that there is increased activity in the vagal efferent neurons. In other words, the hindbrain, the signal goes up the spinal cord through the sensory neurons, through the dorsal root ganglion, gets up there, goes into the hindbrain, which is the back of the brain in the mouse, and increases the activity of the vagus nerve coming back out. So you get decreased catecholamine release and suppression of systemic inflammation. Let me say that again. They were able to show suppression of systemic inflammation, and they were able to hone in on exactly what structure it is, exactly what kind of neuron, and show that the specificity of points is no longer in doubt. The way they did the study is rather fascinating. They had the ability to go in and characterize specific molecular markers on the neurons and map to where they went. Then, having done that, they went and looked at, they used stomach 25 and stomach 36. They're on the same channel. And they were able to show that a particular type of fiber called the TD tomato, love the name, fiber, were tenfold higher in the stomach 36 site. They then created mice that didn't have this particular type of receptor. And I have to share with you, I always read the methods sections, but I usually don't bore you with the methods. But this one is just so cool, I have to share it. They messed around with mice in which they limited the expression of the diphtheria toxin receptor. Yes, there's a thing, a specific receptor for diphtheria toxin, and it's in all mammals. And they basically took it out of all the DNA except for this particular neuron. Amazing that they have this level of resolution, isn't it? So they let the mice be born and then and grow up, and then they gave them diphtheria toxin injection. This destroyed those neurons because it's a toxin, right? So the toxin honed in on the neurons that had the receptor and destroyed them. And so now they had mice who did not have this particular receptor. And when they stimulated them with low micro-intensity electrical stimulation, about 0.5 milliamp if you're interested, they were able to show the hindbrain vagal efferent neurons being activated. They could see that, and they could see improved levels of acetyltransferase, which you would expect to see in an acetylcholinergic neuron. So very strong proof of concept. Then, having done that, they poisoned the mice by giving them a lipopolysaccharide, bacterial endotoxin. And they measured the pro-inflammatory cytokines. You'll remember some of these from spring of 2020. Tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukin 6, interleukin 1. And what they saw in the LPS-treated mice who were stimulated that had the intact receptor, they saw a 50% reduction in those inflammatory mediators and a 40% increase in survival. Then they went and took the mice that they had made that did not have functional receptors anymore because they had destroyed them with the toxin, and they did the same exact experiment. And guess what? They didn't get a decrease in the production of inflammatory cytokines, and they didn't get a decrease in survival. So they did other studies, and I'm not going to, I know we're getting pretty deep into the weeds here, and I won't go into it, but there were a series of other validating studies that basically established that the neurons in the deep fascia, in the deep tissues, like, for example, the interosseous membrane that you're sitting right on top of at stomach 36, if you get down into that deep fascia and stimulate it, it has a very strong anti-inflammatory pro-survival effect. Now, this solves a lot of problems in terms of showing that acupuncture isn't hocus pocus, because you didn't get the change when you hit stomach 25. You didn't get any of this improvement in survival. So it's not just, oh, stimulate the place anywhere and you're going to get something. To me, brings it back to this idea that that old Chinese professor said long ago, the wisdom of the ancients, if you will, if you want to live a long time, control your inflammation, and if you want to control your inflammation, put Moxa on Stomach 36 every morning. So, Secret of the Universe, brought to you here. Hope you enjoyed it. Looks like we got email. Okay, this is a cold read, folks, so cut me some slack. Dear Dr. Dawn, I am a 76-year-old female who is in overall good health. I was diagnosed with a sinus infection a couple of weeks back. The ENT came to this conclusion after a CT scan seemed to rule out other causes of losing my ability to smell and taste. I'd also been feeling a bit like I had a cold for a while. I'd come over some weeks, 3 PCR-type COVID tests, and they all came back negative. I think she meant I'd had done over some weeks, but you know autocorrect. Okay, yesterday I completed 10 days of amoxicillin, and I also had taken an oral steroid for 6 days. Unfortunately, I don't feel any better. I've followed your advice from a prior show on what probiotics to take, thank you very much, but my abilities to smell and taste have not returned. I'm wondering what the next step should be. I also have a follow-up appointment scheduled with my ENT. Also, I don't normally have sinus infections. Thanks in advance, Liz in Pacific Grove. Okay, Liz, well, let's start with how long it takes to regenerate a nerve. So before we get into whether or not your sinus infection's been cured by 10 days of amoxicillin, I'll just talk about that. If I smash a nerve, let's say I crush it, the nerve is going to actually degenerate, and it's going to take a long time to come back. It will often come back completely, particularly if the nerve sheath has not been destroyed, because it can regrow back out along the pathway, the tunnel, if you will. But this takes a long time. Roughly a inch a week, starting from the spinal column, or in this case, starting from the brain. So what we've been seeing in people whose receptors are knocked out by COVID is we're seeing that it's 3 months minimum to get recovery. And that's in mild cases. In some people, it's taking much longer, and there's probably a lot of biological variability. And as far as your sense of taste goes, I'm betting if you put some salt in your mouth and mushed it around, you would taste salt. And if you put something astringent and sour, like lemon juice, in your mouth, same thing. Ditto for sugar, or maybe K-Row syrup or something, which would spread much more rapidly than table sugar. So you've still got your basic taste buds. The problem is the basic taste buds aren't really where we taste. We taste with our nose. Our nose is far more sensitive than you think, and we are able to use our sense of smell in, you know, really phenomenal ways. In fact, I had a story about smell that I didn't think I would be getting to, but I'm going to pull it out because it's so germane. What that shows is the speed of the transmission from smell. There's no synapse from your nose to your brain. In fact, the olfactory bulb goes right back into the brain, splits into multiple channels, and directly goes to brain centers. So unlike vision and hearing, where there's a synapse and thus a delay, odor signals get to the brain within about 100 milliseconds after hitting the nose. And that is very, very fast. In fact, they've done studies looking at the reflex for withdrawing when you smell a bad smell, and that's what the study was talking about as well. And basically, it goes from the nose into the brain, synapses once with the motor nerves on the neck, and causes you to pull your face back away from the smell and withdraw your shoulders. You didn't decide to do that. Your brain did it for you. That wrinkling of the nose, everything like that, that's all unconscious and automatic and reflex. Another type of reflex, a really important one, and that's where your taste comes from. So it may be a while. You want to be really careful about being sure that you eat protein supplements and that you get enough calories, because it's very easy for people to lose weight. You know, when you get into your 70s, we really don't want you having rapid weight loss. So important to watch the nutrition, maybe even make yourself eat. Probably doing strong flavoring will help. So this might be a time to pull out the lemon juice and the vinegar and things like that, just to give you some sort of input into your brain to keep you eating. Now back to your sinuses. That's a different story. I rarely stop with short antibiotic courses. First of all, most sinus infections have a component of a drainage issue. The reason you have the infection is that you have a drainage problem. If you get a stagnant pond, what's going to happen? It's going to fill with pond gunk. And part of that pond gunk is going to be fungal, because there's fungal spores, as we just heard on the Talk of the Bay. There's fungal spores in the environment. There'll be some fungus in there. There'll be some bacteria, probably more than one kind of bacteria. Those entities, while they're up there doing your sinus infection, they build themselves a little coral reef called a biofilm. And when you give someone particularly oral antibiotics, you don't really get a high enough level of penetration into that biofilm. Literally, it sweeps the bugs under the rug. So what you need is drainage, and that's where steam and sinus rinses and things like that come in. And those are a very important component to the management of sinusitis and really critical. You also have to look at if you have allergies, that's going to cause swelling. And so using for a brief period of time, because I don't like giving antihistamines long-term to our seniors, but yes, antihistamines, if you have allergies, you need to get those tissues draining and you need to get them cleaned out. I use silver spray, colloidal silver, which you can squirt up there, which does a good job at suppressing all bacteria and all fungi, or just about all. So that's a blessing. And it's very difficult for resistance to silver and copper to happen. So I'm counting on those for the foreseeable future. Maybe doing facial saunas or facial steams with menthol or camphor, which causes your nose to run. That's also creating a rinsing action. Some functional medicine doctors, I don't typically do this for sinusitis, but some people will take digestive enzymes, particularly plant digestive enzymes, like papain, which is from papaya, and bromelain, which is from pineapple. These can help you digest your food, but they can also break down biofilms, but they have to be taken on an empty stomach. And this is one of those situations where it actually helps if you have a leaky gut, because those molecules, more of them are going to pass into the circulation intact. But they'll get into the lymph. The lymph will go everywhere. It'll get recirculated up into the sinuses and maybe do you some good. And it's pretty harmless. So I think you need to do more to make sure you clear that sinus infection than just take 10 days of antibiotics, because the bugs just didn't get in there and go to town without some advantages, and those advantages are still there. So the bugs are probably not fully eradicated. So you got to clean out the sinusitis, and then you got to wait, because it'll be a while before your nerves come back. And in the meantime, work hard not to lose weight. We're just getting into some emails. This first one from Sybil in Soak. Dear Dr. Don, about 3 weeks ago, I was shocked and angered about pharmacist Ben Fuchs, who has a show in the morning on a local radio station, when he was talking about vaccines. He himself is not vaccinated and discouraged the listeners from getting the COVID vaccine, confirming to all the callers its toxicity, claiming it is experimental and that vaccines in general are the leading cause of autoimmune diseases. Unfortunately, I didn't listen to this show live and so couldn't call in, but I will send him an email and write what I have seen on a t-shirt. Unity, the state or fact of being united, harmony within and among individuals in a group. Unity is built on a shared vision, hope, and cause for the common good. What would you tell him, Dr. Don, specifically about his statement about vaccines being the leading cause of autoimmune disease, which I believe is misinformation, that will ultimately prevent many listeners from getting the vaccine? How do we allow such misinformation to spread over the airwaves unchallenged? Well, that last question, of course, is rhetorical, and I'm not going to address it. But I would have a few words for Mr. Fuchs. The leading cause of autoimmune disease is overactive immune systems. This has many causes. It's always multifactorial. There is never one cause. For example, if a person is diabetic and has high insulin levels because of insulin resistance, they will become inflamed more readily. They already have inflammatory chemical signals circulating in their system, so it takes less to set them on fire. Viral infections trigger flares of many autoimmune diseases, other infections, bacterial as well, fungal, And the body responds to any infection by releasing many pro-inflammatory chemicals, interleukin-1, interleukin-6, TNF-alpha, interferon-alpha, just to name a few. And just as a rising tide lifts all boats, rising levels of these chemicals stimulate the immune system to mount an attack against all the targets it can find, including very mistaken attacks against innocent bystander cells. And that's autoimmune disease. I would tell Ben that I wished I lived in a simple world like his, a world of clear-cut correlation equals causation, a world where lives could be saved by burning the village witch. But actually, I don't think Mr. Pharmacist believes that either. We live in a strange, irresponsible time where yelling fire in the theater is considered okay and even, you know, you're right and a smart way to make money. I made a promise as a young MD to do no harm, or at least do no harm on purpose. I'd like to know, please, if there are pharmacists in the audience, reach out and let me know. I wonder if pharmacists have a similar oath. Our next email comes from David. David writes, here's an extract. Please take a look. New fecal microbiota for cancer patients. I'm going to kind of give you a little bit of background here about something called anti-programmed cell death protein. So first of all, this is a kind of therapy where you are trying to block something that is blocking programmed cell death. If you programmed cell death in cancers is what you want. Cancers are good at blocking that using a protein called anti-programmed cell death protein 1 or PD-1. What we like to do is use our drug therapy to block that. But we find that in treating melanoma with this very effective therapy in some people, it's not at all effective in others. And what we find is that it depends on the gut microbiota. So in other words, the microbiome determines whether or not people can respond to this life-saving therapy. So in this study, what they did was they gave microbiome transplants to people with PD-1 refractory melanoma who weren't responding to the therapy. They showed that they got an increased response to anti-PD-1, that they increased CD8 cell activation, and they saw less cells that are called interleukin-8 expressing myeloid cells. These are immune suppressant cells. So essentially, they were able to reverse the immune suppression, and they were able to improve the ability of the body to turn these cancerous cells dead by activating programmed cell death. So this is enormously interesting that they did this with a fecal microbiota transplant. The next question is, if you weren't using these drugs and all you got was a reduction in the myeloid cells, would there be benefit there? This was not a study where they treated the responders, but I am betting that this is a multifactorial effect and that the microbiome and doing microbiome therapy may be one of the more fruitful ventures in understanding the microbiome, because cancer is an emergency and there's lots of interest and desire to find ways of treating it more effectively. And let's be fair, there's also funding and career opportunities in someone who is successful in that. Another email from Tim talking about ivermectin and cheap drugs. He sent me a link. I looked at the link. I really do try to keep an open mind about this, but Tim, please, a little critical thinking, okay? Correlation does not equal causation. The website that you sent me had a graph showing the case rates in Indonesia going up in July 14th of 2021. And it also had a graph showing that web searches for ivermectin in Indonesia went up around the same time. Okay, so what? The case spike that the person used showed a very, very suspicious rapid drop in cases over the course of about a week and a half. They attributed that to ivermectin. I look at that and I say, did they run out of tests? This is a third world country. They had 50,000 people in one day. So did they just run out of tests? Did the testing drop because they weren't testing everybody who got sick? And the thing was based on the idea that everybody took ivermectin, and that's why the cases dropped so much. But a web search for ivermectin doesn't mean you got it, as anybody who drank that particular Kool-Aid and tried to get a hold of ivermectin recently has figured out. Also, there's a lag time to get a hold of the drug and for it to start working. So it's complete nonsense to assume that these two curves prove anything. But without actually just looking past the curve and saying, oh, look, they drop at the same time. It must be cause and effect. It's like web searches do not equal drug use. Okay? Please. It's just a mirage that someone is throwing at you. And some of the mirages do come from our own government. And so I want to just briefly respond. Brad in SoCal, who sent me a very well thought out email that I'm not going to read, but essentially making the point that the CDC, the NIH, the FDA have a mixed report here, and that some things went well and some things didn't, and everybody is mad about the initial statements about don't wear masks and thinks that it was to get them for the healthcare providers. And maybe it was. I really don't know. I know that I never stopped wearing masks. I know that people were sitting up late at night with sewing machines, sewing cloth masks right away. So I don't know that. I think most people didn't buy that masks don't help, except the people who didn't think COVID was a thing in the first place. And so I don't know. I just have to say thank you for a very well thought out point of view. And I think you make some points, but I also think that my editorial about not expecting superhuman powers from science, because we're not superheroes. We're very human, and we make a lot of cognitive errors, but we fix them. And that's what I like about science compared to religion or political opinion. We are willing to cop to our errors and change our minds. So here's another one about COVID. This is not an email, actually. This is an article. Some people say they'd rather get infected with COVID than get vaccinated. They're half right. Probably the smartest thing you could do, although it's a gamble, and I don't recommend it, is get sick, survive, and then get vaccinated. Because people who recovered from COVID previously and were then immunized have a much stronger response, and their antibodies are different. Now, this isn't too surprising. In one research study, people, and this was way back in 2020, these many years, a group of people were wondering about mutations, and so they decided to try and create a mutant spike protein that would be fully resistant to the neutralizing antibodies. And what they found was from the vaccinated people, they could create a mutant that would be fully resistant to the neutralizing antibodies. It still worked as a spike protein, but it was different enough. And I'm hoping they did this in like a level 4 safety lab. I'm sure they did. Those who recovered from COVID months and months before they got their vaccine, some of those individuals have antibodies that will attack all the variants of COVID that can possibly function, including many of the natural occurring variants and also other types of coronaviruses like the animal versions. It's very likely that these antibodies will be effective against any future variant. And my regular listeners will remember, because I referred to it last week as well, that people who had SARS-1 in Singapore who had that disease 20 years later when they got their Pfizer vaccine, they too produced super antibodies that were capable of neutralizing all known forms of the coronavirus and of SARS. So the immune system essentially needs enough examples, rather like face recognition, now that I think about it. How do you get good face recognition on an individual? Have lots of that kind of face. Hence, Caucasian males score a lot better with accuracy than African American females, just because whose pictures were being taken in the tech labs that were designing this stuff. And we know that our immune system is working rather like that kind of facial recognition. So the more samples it gets, the better it's going to be. This is an established thing, but a little more detail about it. This hybrid immunity is due to something called a memory B cell. Memory B cells live in the lymph node and they live a long time. When you give a vaccine to someone and they get that bump of antibodies, they're actually using short-lived cells called plasmablasts to make those antibodies. And those die off. They also found, and this I thought was really interesting, that the longer you get past the vaccine, the more these beta memory cells actually evolve. In other words, they aren't just using the antibodies that they were first producing. The antibodies actually change over time and gain mutations that help them bind more tightly to the spike protein. Now, we've already discovered, and I've reported, that the virus seems to stay in the gut. And I'm wondering if the lymph nodes as well keep a little virus around as a captive lab rat used for testing these new variants to validate their future production and say, oh, we're on a good track here. Wouldn't it be amazing if the body was actually doing its own kind of science on this, as well as its own kind of artificial intelligence? Or I guess it's not, I guess it's BI, right? Biological intelligence. But why would this all be? If you stop and think, it's really no surprise, because there's a big difference between being vaccinated and being infected. So think about infection, right? The virus starts in the nose, and then it spreads to the gut, and it also simultaneously spreads to the lungs. And then eventually, if you get really sick, it spreads into the bloodstream. But that's a huge surface area there, the gut and the lungs. You know, we're talking about, for the lungs, it's about 30 meters squared, and in the gut, it's about 32 square meters. And all of that tissue, the gut and the lungs, have tons of lymph nodes, tiny little lymph nodes, just right inside the skin, get ready to start producing antibody against whatever gets through to start stemming an infection, because those are the two places, through the mouth, into the lungs, or into the gut, that infections come into the body. We're basically a very sophisticated donut with a couple of holes in the middle, and one of those holes is into our lungs, and the other one's through us, in and out the other side. So that's an infection. Now, in a vaccine, the virus is injected into the muscle, either the mRNA for the virus or the protein, the spike protein itself, and that depends on which vaccine you got. But it's going into a localized area, an area that isn't all that richly full of lymph nodes. It spreads to the regional lymph node, which is why sometimes you'll get sore in your underarm when you've had your tetanus shot, where the memory cells begin being stimulated. And it's totally mysterious to me how you get a good reaction from vaccine, given how different it is from infection. But evidently, you know, you can take a look at measles, you can take a look at polio, and clearly vaccination works. So we get from an infection lifelong immunization most of the time, lifelong immunity, I mean to say. But sometimes not. Sometimes people can get it again. Coronavirus, ironically, is one where we don't see lifetime immunity. Although if you caught all 30 of the current common cold viruses over the course of, say, the first 2 years that your kid was in preschool and kindergarten, you're pretty bomb-proof for more viruses for a while. And ask any grade school teacher, and they will tell you that after a certain period of time, they almost never get colds. And they keep almost never getting colds until they get into their 60s, and then their natural immunity wanes, and they start to have more problem fighting off respiratory infections. So it seems like natural immunity allows the body to continue to evolve its treatment and keep step with the evolution, presumably, of the diseases, which also change over time in many cases. So what about people get boosted? And what about 2, 4, 7 months after the booster? Well, we don't have that data yet. But because people who got infected are, you know, at least a year ahead of the people who got vaccinated. But what we are starting to see is some indication that maybe this latest booster that's being promoted, that you will eventually get this pool of high-quality B cells, memory B cells, that will allow you to be widely protected over SARS. What I really want is I want to get a SARS-1 vaccine. I want the SARS-1 spike protein. I want to be exposed to it. It just makes so much sense, given what we're learning, that if somebody, I hope somebody's doing that, because maybe the people in Singapore are, but it makes such sense that if you get multiple samples of the variations, the extremes of how that face can look, up, down, right, left, three-quarter profile, you're going to be able to recognize it. Ditto with the spike protein. If you see all the possible manifestations and angles on the spike protein that can evolve without destroying its function, well, then you've got a good chance of being able to hit it with one of your many, many multitude of antibodies. So we're hoping that people who are vaccinated will eventually develop a widespread hybrid-like immunity. But seriously, folks, if you had COVID and you've been on the fence about vaccination, this latest data, you really, really need to be think about changing your mind about that. It's so, so clear that that is exactly what you want for yourself and for your immune system. Our next article, and not get into any deep science, I've given you enough deep science today. I got some goodies, but they're tech. So let's go with something not so tech. And that's plastics and plasticizers in fast foods. Okay? We have a problem. Oh my God. Law of unintended consequences. You know how when you go to, oh, you pick it. I actually occasionally go to Starbucks and they do touch my food. Those gloves, those vinyl gloves. Well, those nice soft vinyl gloves contain plasticizers. And what researchers at the George Washington University did was they went and bought fast foods at popular outlets, and they found 11 harmful chemicals in the samples. Phthalates, the stuff that was outlawed in children's pacifiers and children's toys because it was known to disrupt the endocrine system. Other plasticizers. And here's the thing, folks. We know BPAA bad, phthalates bad. The problem is all of the plasticizers have similar chemical properties. And as we start to do research on them, guess what? They turn out to be bad as well. So what the researchers found, among other things, they purchased 64 fast food items from different restaurants, and then they asked for 3 pairs of unused food handling gloves. And sure enough, the correlation between the chemicals in the gloves from the restaurant and the chemicals in the food was between 80 and 100%. So pretty high. Worst foods were cheeseburgers and chicken burritos. They had the highest levels of the chemicals. Cheese pizzas had the lowest levels. I think those might be handled largely with utensils. When they looked at food that was cooked at home, much, much lower levels of plastic. And that made me feel very good because I've been worried about the fact that a lot of my food is transported in plastic. Not just the stuff that I buy, but also in the factory, when it's packaged, it goes through industrial tubing. It might be in a glass package, but that grape jam might have been sitting in a retort that ran hot jam through plastic tubing to drop it into the canned food. Well, guess what? Heat will definitely cause plasticizers to migrate out of plastic tubing. You've got food conveyor belts. You've got those trucks running around carrying milk that are lined with plastic on the inside. You've got the, as I said, the outer packaging, and you've got the plastic bottles that so many things come from. I'm paranoid enough about this that I avoid things like acidy foods like orange juice, like the little yellow lemons that you get lemon juice in. I won't use those because that's plastic and acid. Oils migrate more readily. because the plastic, these plasticizers are nonpolar, so they're going to migrate into the oil much more than they will into water. But they will, over time, especially if that water bottle gets heated, the plasticizers will migrate into water. And once upon a time, I had an earthquake stash in a black garbage can sitting out in the sun for about 5 years. And when I pulled some of that water and drank it, it had a distinctly plastic taste. So given enough time in your car, and that plastic water bottle is probably leaching all kinds of material. So my point here, as you probably know, is you've got to think not only about what you eat, what the thing you ate, but you also have to think of how it was processed. And the closer you can get to stuff that looks like something that grew on a tree or looks like an animal or a bit piece of an animal, the better off you are. Learn to process your own food and be very, very careful about your choices, because a lot of these chemicals, we aren't good at getting rid of them. And it's looking like this may be a piece of the diabetes epidemic amongst the young. It's really, the evidence is pretty strong and accumulating all the time. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.